This is a way to encourage people to provide a higher amount of affordable housing as part of their project. We know we can't build our way out of the affordable housing needs for San Francisco, and we don't have enough subsidy to meet all those needs. So this is a way for the city to not provide subsidy, but get affordable housing, including for the middle income. The trade-off is we'll have some buildings in each neighborhood that are higher heights than what people are used to seeing. Not higher heights than any of the buildings in the other neighborhoods, but higher than what people are used to seeing.
So at the public meeting at the Ortega Library, one of the speakers who went up, who was invited, was Peter Cohen from the Council of Community Housing Organizations. And he had some questions that I thought were really interesting about this, that obviously he thinks that should be addressed. And I was wondering if we could listen to some of those, and then you could maybe address them, because
sure.
It seems like he has an inside track as to what really needs to be known here. So here's the first one.
Is all this really necessary by state density bonus law? You heard the premise that this is required, the supervisor said, because the city is out of compliance and therefore this must be done. We beg to differ about what exactly needs to be done. There is a compliance with state density bonus law, but it's important that we actually distinguish between what is coming into exact conformance and what the city is trying to do as a matter of policy to incentivize more housing and more affordable housing, which isn't a bad thing in and of itself. But I think that needs to be very carefully looked at so we don't just assume that everything that's on the table here is because the city has to. There is a gray space between what's being required and what is actually a proposed policy.
So there's a state density bonus law that's been on the books since 1979. The state law is very prescriptive. And there's in our program, there's a couple different tracks. One of them is what we call the state analyze, and that really implements the state law. It's based on the analysis we did, and that gets people to about 13% affordability if they do rental units.
So developers need to provide almost 13% affordable units when they build a place.
Correct. If they were just meeting the intent of the state law, or if it's an ownership project, they would need to build 20% affordability to get to a 35% density bonus. That's literally what's required by the state law. When we did all our analysis and found those results, we were really unsatisfied with that in the context of Prop K. We wanted to see a program that could get us to 30% affordability. Also, the state law does not provide incentives for projects that are providing affordable housing for middle-income households. We really wanted a program that could help target those people. So the local program, which is a part of our whole package, is not required by state law, but we think it's really important to help us meet our San Francisco-specific local housing goals.
And is it legal under state law to provide? I guess it's not legal to require certain affordability, but it is to incentivize it.
Correct. By state law, if someone provides affordable housing, either because they're required by our inclusionary program or because they elect to, we must offer them certain density benefits. Our local program goes further. It goes beyond, it builds on that framework and offers incentives for projects to meet our local affordable housing goals.
All right, here's another question from Peter Cohen that he asked at the Ortega Public Library.
What the city has formally defined as middle income stretches all the way from 50% of the median income, so for a single person, it's about $45,000 or so a year, all the way up to 150. It's a big span. The middle class is a lot of different folks. The question is, where on that spectrum from 50 to 150 do you want to make sure this housing is affordable? And I think that's a legitimate question. 120, 140 may be the right spot. What about 80? What about 90? What about 100? So it's for you folks to think about who are we trying to serve, because those are very specific affordability targets. Either you're overqualified or you're underqualified.
Yeah, and I expect this to be a big part of the conversation because, as I've said, we can't fund all the affordable housing we need, and we also can't encourage private developers to provide all the affordable housing we need. So if you kind of imagine all of our affordable housing tools creating X number of units, the question is, how do we want to best direct each program? I really think of this program as providing affordable housing for a number of different groups. At the end of the day, if everyone chose the local program, we would have about 2,000 units that are affordable to people earning 55 or 90% of our income. So that's what our current inclusionary housing program targets.
And which is about how much in dollars?
Great question. For the average household of a single person, it's about $74,000 for one person. So you could go down, I think, about $7,000 to get to 90, or down further to get to the 55%.
And what percentage of that income measures is what should be affordable for them?
Yeah. So the number one definition of affordable, which is kind of universal regardless of what your income is that you should be spending no more than 30% of your income.
Isn't that like a percentage from about 20 years ago? Because now isn't it more like 70% or something that people are paying?
Well, what people are paying versus what they can afford to pay and live comfortably, I think, is the theory. So, you know, there's been some more recent conversation around, well, what about transportation costs are going down? Or if you live in a city, you aren't, you know, owning a car, you can afford to spend a little bit more. I'm not even going to start to go into the mortgage crisis and what percentages we were letting people go up to at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
that was definitely getting over 50.
Right. So a good standard and the practice that we have for all our local programs is you should be paying about 30% of your income for housing.
That'd be a real breath of fresh air for a lot of San Franciscans, I think.
Yeah. And as you can imagine, the lower income you are, the more sensitive you are to that, right? If you're middle income or upper income, you can maybe afford a little bit more. So that's the question about, you know, what is affordable housing? And then who are the middle income? You know, I think that conversation is also, again, it's like the goal is to, for me, with all of our programs, when you put them all together, is to have a diversity of income groups in the city that are stabilized. I think that's the thing that most people are really concerned about is that, you know, we're going to see some title change. And then when the tides go back out, we're not going to look like the diverse city we all came to live in. So I think the critique from some people has been, you know, public subsidies should be really reserved for the lower income. And should we be going up to 140% of the area median income?
Which is a pretty good income.
Which is a pretty good income for a single person, and for a family of four, I think it's quite challenging to make work. And imagining moving
the way
to San
the housing
Francisco
market
now.
Is right now,
correct. Mm-hmm. So, at the end of the day, I think the answer is this is about diversity, and we want to make sure that we have a really good mix in our community. We don't want to become a city of very low income and extreme wealth.
That's Kirsten Dissinger. She is with the San Francisco Planning Department. Let's hear again from Peter Cohen from the Council of Community Housing Organizations speaking at the Ortega Public Library at a public meeting concerning the Affordable Housing Bonus Program.
This is a big program, folks. It might take 20 years. But this, I would argue, for a lot of the city, is a very significant change in zoning and development potential, right, that hasn't happened in a long time. What about the infrastructure that comes with it, right? So this is a question we always ask, right? In affordable housing or otherwise, what about the transit infrastructure? What about the community facilities? Is there sufficient childcare in the neighborhood? How are those kinds of infrastructure improvements paid for? Does that come as part of the development? Again, very big, thorny questions. Kirsten went through a 10-year planning process in Market Octavia. We've done a lot of area planning in the east side of the city. This isn't area planning. This is just a zoning program. But the same questions about sufficient infrastructure should be asked.
See, he asked some interesting questions.
So, right. So in terms of infrastructure matching housing development, I think that's something that we really developed in our area plans and got really good at. So we do have all these impact fees, which basically means every time you build a new unit, you pay a certain amount to the city. And that money goes towards transit, open space, childcare facilities, all these different needs. Some of these fees are citywide, meaning everybody pays them no matter where you develop. Some of the more detailed ones came out of our area plans. What we're seeing now, and our board just approved a transportation impact fee, which means where it used to be just collected on commercial facilities, now citywide any new residential development will start paying into a citywide fund to help us increase our transportation infrastructure. The board is also currently considering a similar citywide fee for childcare. All of those ideas, sort of the work behind that, came out of our area-specific work. I led something called the Citywide Nexus Study, which was this legal document that shows the connection between new development and the demand for new infrastructure. And that legal document actually helps us start to establish some of these fees citywide. So that's one piece. But the other thing is, most of our infrastructure dollars aren't going to come from impact fees. They're really, you know, a way to leverage other sources like federal and state grants, and then also local sources. And so our capital planning committee has been working really hard to come up with some priorities around, you know, what do we spend our extra capital funding on? How do we start thinking strategically as a city? Our first priority is life safety. They have like 7 or 8, but just recently they've started to really take growth and new development to be one of the criteria for ranking where we invest our capital dollars. So as a city, we're learning how to think more strategically about linking new growth with capital improvements. So I think, you know, I think we're going to be there, and we are working on a update to our transportation plan. In the next couple of years, we hope to have a strategic update to the entire transportation plan, which will take into account all of the growth that could be enabled through this program.
Even though this program is projected for maybe 20 years.
Right. So we do our transportation planning on a 20 or 40 year basis. So we're talking major infrastructure, not, you know, kind of where should the bus stop be here or there, but more like
the jetpack lanes.
The jet. Right. I'm on your wave there. Yeah. The jetpack lanes or any steps we might take in between there, like bus rapid transit or express buses, things that really help move larger amounts of people more efficiently and effectively.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's hear another question. This is one that I think really impacts the way in which the city deals with families.
Will this program result in family units? You heard that talked about. What's being required in the so-called local program is 40% of the units are 2 bedrooms. The rest can be small units. What we know is the market tends to build small units because it's the most profitable way to construct. You can get studios or even micro units or 1-bedroom units, which work fine for singles or perhaps couples or folks who are coming through fairly quickly. But if we're looking for family units and middle-income family units, they got to be at least 2 bedrooms or larger. So 40%, is that enough? Can we get more percentage of those units being family? Second, and related to that, is what is a family unit? A 2-bedroom unit in and of itself doesn't have any size standards. We're getting very small 2-bedroom units on the east side of the city, building 750 square feet in my neighborhood. So part of the question is, what are the standards that we all want for a family unit? Supervisor, I think that's a very important question. I know Supervisor Yee's talking about that. What does it take to have housing for families so they can go through a life cycle and not just squeeze themselves into something that's called a quote-unquote 2-bedroom? So the size matters.
So to clarify that question a little bit, the requirements under the Affordable Housing Bonus Program you guys are proposing, that the city is proposing, that Kitty Tang and Mayor Lee are proposing, is that there would have to be a certain amount of 2-bedroom apartments offered as part of these developments, right? Could you explain how this works a little bit and then address the size issue?
Sure. So this is an idea that came up in our modernizing of zoning on the eastern sides of the city. So we decided, and we're not alone as a city, many cities are deciding that the way to regulate density is not by some random ratio of units to lot area, but rather, like, let's talk about the building form we want, and then the height and the bulk of a building would regulate the density, how many units fit in there. And there was a pretty serious concern that, you know, given no other limits, people would just put lots of studios or 1-bedroom apartments in there.
Because it's worth more money.
Or, yeah, you've got more units. That might work, especially in some markets, you know, in some areas where, you know, more young people are looking to live.
Just look for a place to sleep.
Correct. So we added what we call the unit mix requirement, which is where we require that 40% of your total unit count should be 2 bedrooms or larger.
2 bedrooms or more units.
Or 3-bedroom or 4-bedroom.
But not by square foot.
Correct. And there are some definitions, mostly in the building code, around what is a bedroom. So there are some limitations to what, you know, I think you need to have: life safety, egress, size, access to light. You can't sort of have a bedroom in the middle core of a building, for example. And that program has been really successful, actually. The reason we came up with 40% back then, if I recall, was in 2008, was to sort of, we looked at all of our existing housing stock and we were like, well, what ratio of larger units do we have now? What ratio of single and studio units? And we just kind of wanted to reflect that. Interestingly, 60% of our households are one person. So that kind of lines up as well in terms of, are we building the right kind of housing stock?
For the current population.
For the current population.
Though we've got such a small percentage of families.
Correct.
And to encourage more families to come here or stay here as to become families, then
right.
We need to build differently.
That's certainly one way to think about it. There also is a lot of study going on nationally around who's moving to the cities, right? And it's two populations, young professionals and seniors. And they kind of have the same needs. They want a small house that's near transit and that has services around them. But family housing is a really important goal. And we've been working with Supervisor Yi and others to think about, how do we make this program do better than what our existing controls do? Because we are seeing a lot of two bedrooms in our current planning, but not bigger. People aren't incentivized to provide three. So with this legislation, what we're doing is saying, look, we want to create incentives to provide three-bedroom units as well. The rule specifically that we're proposing, which we think works really well, we worked out with some of our architects, was either you make 40% of the units two-bedroom, or you make 50% of the bedrooms in units that are two-bedroom or more. Yeah, exactly. Complicated.
Just raised my eyebrow.
Yeah. But what that means is people would have a reason to provide, rather than three two-bedroom units, they could provide fewer units. Well, yeah, they could provide the equivalent three-bedroom units. So there's an incentive to get those bigger units, which we think are really what people are looking for when they're talking about family housing there.
When you hear concerns or criticism of changing the height or density of these buildings, as we heard in the Sunset District by a lot of the more vocal people who were there, or you might hear in other parts of the city where there's proposed taller buildings with greater density, because they're afraid that it's going to affect the character of neighborhoods. I mean, how do you address that? How can you address that as a planner when you have said even that the city needs to build more units?
Right. I mean, I think you have to consider it as trade-offs, rather. There's a lot of people that, you know, walk down Geary Boulevard and say, why are the buildings so short? And then there's a lot of people that walk down Geary Boulevard and say, I like this just the way it is, right? And so you have to realize that, you know, in each room, there's sort of a different sort of preference or predilection towards that. And I think you have to take people's concerns seriously, because we're all invested in living in the city and in staying in the neighborhoods that we chose, right? But at the same time, our own perception about what that neighborhood is and how it exists isn't sort of universally correct. It has to be melded and blended with a lot of the other perspectives.
And what message did you hear on November 3rd, on Election Day, when there were so many housing ballot measures that were up?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a really complicated election. I think the thing I was really happy about is seeing Prop A pass, because to me that kind of reinforced what we heard the previous year with Prop K. So Prop K was the initiative that said 33% affordable housing, right? So this is a city that's saying we want to see a lot of affordable housing, and they backed that up again this year with Prop A by voting for a bond to support affordable housing. So to me, those two messages show that, you know, we tried to do an affordable housing bond before I worked for the city even several years ago, and it failed. I think it was 2004 or 5.
Two of them failed in a row.
Two of them failed in a row. You've got deeper history than I do. But, you know, and honestly, the need for affordable housing was present at that time, but it wasn't as intense. And I think what we're hearing is this need is so intense, you know. And so a lot of people ask, well, why now? And maybe it's that we didn't have sort of the political energy to do the right thing until now, right? Maybe we all knew we should grow more back in 2000. You know, in 2010, we did a whole study on the need for middle-income housing. We need solutions. But now the tension is so high that we're able to sort of take these important steps forward. I think everyone is feeling it and hearing it and understanding that we do need more affordable housing to remain a diverse and inclusive city.
Well, on the election front, too, I was really struck by Prop D, because Prop D, in the name of affordable housing, then completely blew the roof off of what height limitations had been in that particular part of San Francisco. And I think that when people start seeing 11 to 21 story buildings in an area where there hadn't been anything that was like that before, that's going to be a real significant change. Yeah, so did that one make a statement to you regarding height limitations?
Yeah, the waterfront is kind of its own ecosystem as well. So I didn't kind of, that your observation didn't really resonate with me, but I do think that that's kind of a sign of things to come, right? Like, we are really interested in making affordable housing happen. There have been a lot of big projects proposed. People are looking, you know, our state, our city law says 12%. We're 33% was set by Prop K. We're talking about hitting 40% in a lot of projects.
Like that one in Prop D.
Yeah. And so these trade-offs are real. If we're not going to put, you know, if we can only fund so much, we need to put other things on the table. I actually think, you know, there's a mix of opinions about the outcomes, but I think denser neighborhoods are really great. And so I do think these trade-offs are win-win for a lot of perspectives.
That's Kirsten Dissinger. She is lead housing policy planner at the San Francisco Planning Department. And I'd like to go back to Peter Cohen one last time from the Council of Community Housing Organizations, who spoke at a public meeting that Kirsten was at as well at the Ortega Public Library in San Francisco to talk about the Affordable Housing Bonus Program. I think that this here is one of the most significant questions with anything that requires new planning.
What happens when you have existing buildings on a site? Especially what if they're rent-controlled buildings? And what if there are existing commercial retail tenants in those buildings? Are we inadvertently incentivizing demolition of housing and commercial space? Now hang on a second. I ask these as objective questions, but if that's the case, and you're gonna say take a two-unit building and you're gonna tear it down and build a nine-unit building, are those units gonna be replaced one for one, and the folks who are living there have a right to return? And on top of that, are you going to get the bonus, or are those going to start being double counted?
Yeah, I think this is the toughest question in terms of any change to the urban landscape. You know, it's one thing to talk abstractly about a building being taller than the neighboring building or maybe someone's yard being shaded. But when you're actually talking about displacing residents and tenants, you know, that's where it's sort of the rubber hits the road, as it were, and we're taking this very seriously. The state law requires that any rent control or affordable unit be replaced. But you heard in Peter Cohen's comments, those units also could count as part of their percentage of affordability per the state law. San Francisco is always leading the edge in all kinds of policy, especially affordable housing. A lot of the tools that we all have and take for granted, you know, we might be the only place in the region or the state that have them. And so, again, on the replacement of rent control units, we're working really hard to come up with a solution that we believe has to be in place before this program moves forward, which would say if you're choosing to demolish several rent control units, you must replace them and provide the affordable housing. And we're working to sort of map out those tenant rights as well. There are, as you know, we have pretty strong benefits for people who might be displaced, but we are interested in adding right to return and anything else that we can work out. I will say that by and large, this is not an issue with this program, but it's an issue citywide. You know, we're hearing about this in the Mission. We're hearing about this without this program. The loss of rent control units is kind of, you know, at the forefront of all of our minds. And so we don't think that this is a a control that should apply just to this program. It should just apply, right? We all value our rent control housing stock. There are instances where the trade-off is bad, right? Like two rent control units being demolished for three market rate units is a bad trade-off for the city. So we want to make sure that we're not allowing that, but we're also allowing, you know, if we could provide, you know, 30 new affordable units at the loss of two rent control units, we're clearly winning as a city. So we're trying to sort of map that out. It should also be noted, though, that our program, we looked at about 240 soft sites. We assumed that any site with residential unit was not soft. So we acknowledge that this might happen. But when we talk about how many units this program would produce, the 16,000, if everyone chose the local program, that's assuming zero displacement. And part of that is because we've been listening at the commission and the board, and we're hearing that our decision makers are working really hard to protect those rent control units. So I think that's pretty much the solid answer on that one. I think there's nobody that's in a disagreement with Choo-Choo's perspective on that, or anyone's perspective around protecting both the tenants and the units as a part of valuable part of our housing supply.
So what's next in the process of bringing this before? It's going to go before the Board of Supervisors, right?
That's right. This was legislation that was introduced by Mayor Lee and Supervisor Tang. And the next step is for our Planning Commission to have about two more hearings. We're going to have an informational on December 3rd. And then at City Hall. All of the Planning Commission meetings are at City Hall, room 400. And then at the end of January, I believe it's the 28th, whatever that Thursday is, we'll also have an adoption hearing at our Planning Commission. The Planning Commission makes recommendations to the Board of Supervisors around this proposal. And then the Board of Supervisors would generally hold hearings at the Land Use Committee before making recommendations to the full board.
Are you scheduled to go to any more public meetings around the city the way that there was that one at Ortega?
Yes. We're working with supervisors and community organizations to set up some additional community meetings. I don't believe we have any dates set. December 9th is coming to my mind for a meeting in the Richmond. But we are hoping to reach out and work with community groups over the next couple of months to make sure that we have their input on the program and they understand completely how it's moving forward.
And so could people find out about those public meetings from the webpage with the Affordable Housing Bonus Program?
Yeah.
Information?
So there's endless amounts of information on our website. We've been trying to sort it and organize it. But there's a mailing list that you can sign up on, so you'd be notified about any meetings. You could go to our website and just kind of find out about them. I'd also recommend people dive in a little bit. There's a 2-minute overview video that we've created. We also
Must have been a challenge.
Yeah. You know, I think half the work of this program is getting it down and being able to describe sort of all the trade-offs and complexities in a simple way. But we also put our webinar, which is an hour-long description of the program. So for people who really want to dive in and understand how the mechanics of the program work, that's available online as well, as well as all the studies done by David Baker Architects, Open Scope Studios, Seifel Consulting. If you really, you know, I was told by someone at the Ortega Library that everybody's a housing nerd. So if you're really a housing nerd, there's a lot of material for you to dive into on our website.
Well, if people haven't been housing nerds, I think they're all becoming housing nerds at this point.
That's correct.